A very good afternoon to everyone. My name is Arfina Ara Hussain, and I am a research intern at ICS, and I am the MC for today's session. On behalf of ICS, I welcome you all to today's Wednesday seminar. The topic of today's discussion is Politics and Policies of State-Owned Enterprises in the Jiang Zemin Era. The talk will detail the nuances of state-market relations under Jiang Zemin through an analysis of state enterprise management. It will shed light on Jiang's theory of tree represents and how he sought to replace the idea of class warfare by providing a new utilitarian justification for his reform agenda. The speaker for today's discussion is Dr. Priyanka Pandit. She is an assistant professor at Sivanagar University, Delhi, NCR. Her research interests include international and comparative political economy with an emphasis on China and the developing world, as well as international negotiations and global economic governance. She is currently completing her book project on China's negotiating strategies at the World Trade Organization. Joined as our discussion is Anand P. Krishnan, Visiting Associate Fellow, Institute of Chinese Studies, New Delhi, and guest course instructor, National Law School of India, University, Bengaluru. Joining as our chair is Professor Alka Acharya. She is the Honorary Director of the ICS and Professor at the Center for East Asian Studies, JNU. She has been teaching courses on Chinese foreign policy and political economy to the master's and MPhil students and guiding doctoral research since 1993. Her upcoming publication is on Boundaries and Borderlands, a century after the 1914 Simla Convention. Before I hand over to the chair, I would like to request all the participants to follow some housekeeping rules. Please keep yourself muted during the session. You all can unmute yourself only when you are asked by the chair to do so. Participants can post their questions in the chat box, or they can use the raise hand options during the Q&A session. With that, I now hand over the floor to the chair. Over to you, ma'am.
Thanks, Arfina, and very good afternoon to all of you. It is a great pleasure for me personally, and also, of course, for the Institute to have as our speaker today, Dr. Priyanka Pandit, who is one of our students in the Jawaharlal Nehru University. And as any senior person here will vouch, when your students come up to this this point where they are actually giving you back in many ways, all that they took, that's really the best moment in our lives. So I'm really looking forward to Priyanka's presentation, which is on an extremely topical issue in many ways. It deals with the legacy of the core of the third generation leadership of the CPC in China, Jiang Zemin. Now, obviously, there are many, many, many aspects that we could take up, but Priyanka is going to be focusing on the manner in which the state market relationship, and particularly the move towards establishing a socialist planned commodity economy, was navigated during Jiang Zemin's tenure. We will recall that he comes into the limelight and onto the political stage following the Tiananmen incidents. And that was the time when the right and the left were really once again entering into a fairly formidable tussle. There was a conservative backlash, as it has been termed, against the reforms, market reforms in particular. Jiang Zemin was steering his way very carefully, and it seemed as if he was also almost standing in as a counterpoint to Deng Xiaoping, who insisted that the reforms must go on. And yet Jiang Zemin appeared to be with those who were saying slow down, and maybe the pace was not in the interests of China's economy and its people. So it's really only 1992 or thereabouts at the 14th Party Congress that we see Chiang Sumin actually come out much more decisively in favor of the reforms. And 1992 Party Congress, in fact, has gone down in history as quote unquote one of the most liberal congresses in terms of the documents that came out, which pertain to the market and market reforms and so on. And thereafter, of course, it was a kind of inevitable move towards his signature contribution to that pantheon, which talks in terms of, although his name is not put, Mao Zedong thought, Deng Xiaoping theory, the important thought of the three represents, Sangha Taipia. And so it's really that which brings him into the debate in the West, that Chiang Zemin was the person who actually opened up the gateway for making the Communist Party a capitalist entity. So these are some of the things, controversial, debatable. His legacy also is fairly critically assessed, because the 90s is the decade when China's socioeconomic differences start to widen very, very significantly. Now, in the midst of all this, the state-owned enterprises, which were really the core of the Chinese economy, was also undergoing major shifts. So on that and other issues, we hope to be enlightened by Priyanka's talk. So over to you, Priyanka.
Thank you, ma'am. Thank you so much. Thank you, Institute of Chinese Studies, and especially Alka, ma'am, for inviting me to talk on the theme. Now, it's a real honor and privilege to be able to present my research before my teachers, especially Professor Acharya, Professor Madhvi Thampi, who have actually shaped my thought processes. Now, what I intend to do in the next 30 minutes or so is to talk about key state-owned enterprise reforms undertaken by Chiang Zemin, describe the context of these reforms, and most importantly, reflecting on how Chiang had related to and regulated social and economic relations in China. Now, Chiang Zemin, who became the General Secretary of China's Communist Party in 1989 after the Tiananmen crisis, was mostly seen as a transitional figure, as someone holding the place till a strong man arrived. Now, it was Deng who had remained paramount leader during most of the period. Now, many in China often assumes, and also outside often assumes, that Chiang was not a visionary leader like Mao or a daring reformer like Deng Xiaoping. Mao and Deng changed China, Chiang did not. But then a decade later, in 1999, Chiang was still in place, stronger than ever, holding additional titles, chairman of China's military commission and the president of PRC. Now, all this, of course, did not come easy. Though it had taken years of policy renovation, consensus building, deft maneuvering, and political infighting, he had surprised the world by transforming China into an economic superpower. Under Chiang, China had changed in ways, and many, in fact, after his demise, called him a man with vision, a man who changed China in ways that few had thought impossible, both domestically as well as on the external front. Now, soon after becoming the General Secretary of the party, he took a lot of interest in the status of the special economic zones, and that's something which Deng had guided him to do so, and undertook these inspection tours around the country from Hainan to Tibet to Xinjiang to Liaoning to Guangxi. Now, his frustration grew slowly with China's sluggish growth and stagnant reforms, and particularly to that of the state-owned enterprises. And he declared in an address to the fourth plenum of the 13th Party Congress, "We must do everything to revitalize large and," I quote him, "revitalize large and medium-sized state-owned enterprises. They are the backbone and foundation of our socialist economy." His call to support the development of large enterprises dovetailed perfectly with the new emphasis on revitalizing state-owned enterprises during the post-Tiananmen period. Now, this also marks the beginning of an era of policy experiments in support of large SOE development and also of creating national champions. Now, Chiang had every reason to do so. First, his own working experience in the state-owned enterprises, especially in Shanghai in 1970s and 1980s, and most importantly, the resurgence of the party hardliners, conservatives, post Tiananmen incident. Now, being caught in the middle, Thang on the one hand, the reformist leader, and the hardliners on the other, his strategy was simple. What he did, and that's something which Chiang is known for, was known for, to be able to strike that consensus within the party elites, was to establish some sort of harmony between development and ideology, and which of course increased his chances of acceptance by the party hardliners. Now, in subsequent years, a subtle shift in emphasis occurred as large enterprise strategy came to be framed, not just in terms of SOE revitalization, but also as a means of preparing China for the rigors of international competition vis-a-vis multinational corporations in these liberalized marketplace. Now, this was again in the context of China's negotiations for re-entry. China at first applied for a re-entry. So it did not apply for a new membership. Instead, it sought re-entry to the GATT. And the concern whether Chinese enterprises would be able to dance with the rules in international markets. The process of creating national champions, it was during then gained momentum. Now, what started as pilot projects of 100 enterprises were soon adopted as nationwide policy called Grasp the Large and Let Go of the Small, Chuata Fang Xiao. Now, grasping here meant that large SOEs were to be merged into industrial conglomerates with bank loans and investments, while letting go indicated that small SOEs would be privatized or closed. This period, also known as reform with losers, because the first period where with the introduction of the dual track pricing system and some sort of enlargement of SOE autonomy was mostly known as reform without losers. This marks a departure from the previous period. And this is a period of SOE reforms where which is known as reform with losers, as it resulted in dramatic layoffs and decline in the size of the SOE workforce because of the merging or the grasping that happened. Now, it was motivated by the belief that Chinese enterprises would first have to be big, have to grow big in the domestic market in order to be strong, chuo da, chuo qiang, in international markets. The large enterprise strategy was also woven into the debates about the exercise of state control. And the issue of ownership, again, became a very, very important point of debate within the party. Now, whether party should endorse the controversial idea of converting SOEs into shareholding companies. And if you do that, you allow institutions and individuals, not only the state, to own the means of production. The conservatives were clearly uncomfortable with this idea, and they viewed it very much as synonymous to that of privatization. They charged the new reforms. They charged that the new reforms would definitely take China down the capitalist road. And what they did was they did not even spare. It was the late 1990s. They didn't even spare the recently deceased Deng Xiaoping in their assault. After the 15th Party Congress in 1997, Chiang stated, and of course, that was again his way of building consensus within the party, that while the majority state ownership would remain in lifeline and pillar industries, a portion of inefficient state-owned enterprises could be converted to a shareholding system. It was during then when he backed these financial ideas as company mergers and stock exchange listings, okay, mergers and acquisitions to help revitalize state industries. What he clearly maintained was that the state would play an important role to harness and control markets, and most importantly, to improve the competitiveness of these state-owned enterprises, especially the large SOEs. Now, the development of large enterprise strategy over the 1990s, along with increasing number of diverse forms of ownership, again, reflects the consensus that Chiang was able to form by the end of the decade regarding the state enterprise management. He expanded, and what he did was some sort of political packaging. He expanded the meaning of the term public ownership. And what he did was he included different forms, including collectives, shareholding companies, and this expanded definition was clearly an ideological breakthrough. Now, he spoke of three critical movements for emancipating mind. First, Deng Xiaoping's seek truth from facts, a triumph over Hua Guofeng's Mao worshipping to whatever's in 1978. Second, Deng's sudden tour that revitalized reform in 1992, and the new period in which the reform of ownership would restructure the economy. Now, at the same time, he warned provincial leaders not to go too fast with privatization and to select 1,000 of leading SOEs for continuing government support. Now, theoretically speaking, if we consider this from a macroeconomic perspective, China's experience with large SOEs presents a challenge to the transitional orthodoxy and to ideas concerning property rights in development economics. Now, who viewed, who argued that privatization is an indispensable process and that a rapid transformation of the ownership of the means of production was considered central and necessary to ensure a complete break with that of the old regime, the previous regime. Now, these developments on the external fronts, there are developments on the external front as well that also paved the way for greater state-owned enterprise reforms during China. It was the time when China's application to re-enter GATT was rejected by the GATT director, and where China then decided to make fresh application for GATT membership and later WTO from 1995 as a developing country. And then it agreed that it would observe the obligations that applied to all the developing countries in the GATT and later WTO. The accession-related talks between President Jiang Zemin and US President Clinton also gained steam during that period. The WTO accession-related commitments involved a sharp reduction of tariff rates in manufacturing and agriculture, as well as substantial market liberalization in services. It added more commitments, okay, especially on the conduct of relations between governments and state-owned enterprises, technology transfer, and judicial review. Now, this introduction of these commitments generated new pressures on Jiang Zemin Turanxi leadership to carry out deeper reforms and establish new institutions. Now, in this context, understanding leadership networks under Jiang Zemin becomes crucial. Now, Jiang and Zhu were largely autonomous vis-a-vis the bureaucracy, the central bureaucracy, as the political ties, we have to understand, were largely disembedded from the central state. Leadership ties are disembedded from the central bureaucracy, are considered to be disembedded from the central bureaucracy when the leaders built their careers in the provinces outside the central state. Therefore, in the face of bureaucratic opposition, Jiang Zemin and Zhu Ronji, they were able to effectively discipline the state, punish the detractors, and deploy the central bureaucracy to carry out regulatory reforms. Now, how did he overcome the ideological opposition or the contradiction? It is in his course of applying Deng Xiaoping theory that Jiang Zemin came up with his idea of three represents. The phrase is a literal translation of San Ka Tai Piao. Now, for represents, Zhang uses the common Chinese word Tai Piao, which is the same term used to describe Beijing representative of a foreign company. Jiang's intent was that although communism in its industrial age formulation was not viable as a contemporary economic system, the Communist Party, by representing these three principles, would be modernizing Marxism, advancing with the times, and most importantly, securing its place at the vanguard of the society, as a vanguard of the society. Now, Jiang declared that reform, most importantly, would create a new strata, would result in a new social strata of entrepreneurs, technical personnel, managerial staff, freelance professionals, and the self-employed in the non-public sector, and that most people in the private sector are engaged in labor and work. They obey the law, they contribute to the society. Therefore, in order to maintain the momentum of the reform, Jiang argued that these new social strata should be welcomed as members of the Communist Party. These people, he asserted, are also working for building, most importantly, socialism with Chinese characteristics. Entrepreneurs and technical personnel, he pointed out, are the driving forces behind China's advanced productive forces, the first of his three represents. Now, if such people, in his view, continue to be banned from party membership, he said that the party cannot truly claim to be leading the nation. He had maneuvered around the historically loaded term capitalist, that's again his political packaging, by inventing a new label for this class of potential party members in which private business owners, along with others, would be included. Now, his neo-utilitarian justification, this neo-utilitarian justification, not only weakened domestic resistance to SOE reforms, the revitalization and restructuring of SOE reforms, and most importantly, what it did was it enabled the CPC, the Chinese Communist Party, to reinvent the role of the state in the central bureaucracy. Now, talking about this new utilitarian approach, in contrast, you have to understand again, this has to be contextualized within China's realities. Now, in contrast to the utilitarian approach of laissez-faire economists, which talk about privatization, deregulation, and liberalization, here the Chinese leaders emphasized a normative ethical foundation of economics, where it delineated an important role for the state in setting the framework for economic competition so that it is able to serve the larger interests of the society. And in rejecting the laissez-faire kind of liberal model or the model of liberalization, the proponents of neoliberalism in China, Tang Jiang being one of them, what he did was he challenged the entire notion of separating or market and state being two separate entities. And he also challenged during the process the separation between the political and the economic spheres. Now, what he also did was, during a later Politburo meeting, he defended Chu Ranji's trade deal with the United States, a landmark trade deal in 1999, which actually led to China's accession of WTO after 15 years of negotiations, rigorous negotiations in 2001. And where he stated that given the current China-US relations, Comrade Chu Ranji's visit to the US has achieved our anticipated goal. He has neither deviated from the decision and policy of the Politburo, nor has he erred politically or on principle. The Politburo is responsible for them. The members of the Standing Committee of the Politburo and members of the Politburo, he said, that will explain to the Standing Committee of the NPC and State Council about the trade deal and or defend the trade deal that China just signed with the United States in 1999. He also came out strongly in defense of Chu Ranji's meeting with the American president, and especially in the wake of strong anti-US and anti-WTO accession sentiments, which in fact intensified after the US bombing of Chinese embassy at Belgrade in 1999. Chiang issued the following instruction on WTO accession, and that's again his very, very, very clever maneuvering and deft negotiating skills that comes out, where he says that hold an active attitude, use flexible methods, excel at negotiations, and reserve no naivety. Tai tu qi qi fang fa ling huo, shan yu zhuo sang pu ke tian sen. So, and because he believed that if China could not join the WTO within a year, it would have to make many more concessions the next time around. And therefore, he instructed Chu Ranji to go ahead with the WTO accession at any cost, despite the increasing protests in China about the leaderships getting close to the American counterpart. But Chiang Zemin Churanchi's pace of regulatory response to WTO did not last, especially given the increasing powerful position of SOEs in the economy. The situation somehow changed after the 2008 global financial crisis and the ensuing recession, which strengthened the orthodox voices within the Chinese government. And we all know that when Xi Jinping came to power in 2012, he formally deployed the tools of dialectical materialism to redefine party's central contradiction by shifting the focus away from factors of production. And in fact, he argued to relations of productions. In fact, he argued that it's gone too far and therefore the problems. Emphasizing on the relations of production, he addressed questions of class equality, poverty, unbalanced development, common prosperity. Now, within the state-owned enterprises, what Xi did, what he had bolstered the role of party committees, and which directly contradicts his ambitious agenda of mixed ownership. For the CPC leadership, mixed ownership only remained a fundraising tool for the debt-ridden SOEs, reflecting his, again, deep-seated interest in corporatization or making these state-owned enterprises modern enterprises. Now, from prioritizing SOEs for his flagship Belt and Road Initiative, two mega mergers, acquiring market overseas, the 20th Party Congress has expanded the mandate of the state-owned enterprises as the drivers of China's self-reliance program in innovation and technology building. Now, the new innovation drive in the state-owned sector is being carried out in a highly centralized fashion in which party directives trump market logic, bureaucratic entities dominate commercial businesses, and untested Chinese alternatives take precedence over established products and technologies, thereby exacerbating the dangers already inherent in the risky pursuit of cutting-edge innovation. Now, therefore, the question that comes to our mind is, has China moved away from Jiangzhu Ronchi era completely? Do we see a complete reversal of the course under Xi Jinping, or let's say from 2008 onwards, post-global financial crisis? I think it has to be understood within a context, and again, the historical context, and also depends on how one interprets the context. If we view this as a complete break from the past or a complete reversal of the past, one would like to see then the interim period from Tang to the present years under Xi Jinping as a complete wholesale liberalization, okay? Deregulation, privatization, a wholesale liberalization, which of course with time would result to some amount of westernization. And what Xi Jinping did was he reversed the path and brought China back to the socialist market, socialist planned market economy, taking the pragmatic content out of it, which was the most important flavor under Jiangzhu's era. Now, if we again interpret it as a continuity with the past from Tang Jiangzhu reform period, one would see that this is not a mark or not a marked break with the past. In fact, what China has followed is a deep marketization, deep market reforms, where the state has time and again used market as an important tool to fulfill the political objectives and policy goals, to achieve certain policy goals and priorities. Just that in the era of Xi Jinping, the content of the policy goals or the policy priorities have changed. And therefore, when we understand the transition from Jiang Zemin to Xi era vis-a-vis the SOE reforms or the state enterprise management, we do see an important continuity, be it the shareholding reform and the mixed ownership in case of Xi Jinping. What we need to understand is that the political goals have changed, most importantly, and therefore, again, the shift in ideology which backs these shifting political priorities. I will rest my case here and will be very happy to take up questions. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. I think you have ended on a most intriguing note. I think that's precisely the cue for Anand to take off, I think. Anand, over to you.
Thank you, ma'am. Thank you, Priyanka. That was a very wonderful presentation. As I told Professor Ajaria in the beginning that I'm actually not well prepared. I mean, I was just here as a listener. So thank you. It also helps me bring in some of my work during my MPhil, which was actually looking at the logic or the political logic behind socialist market economy and how the process came from the Tang era and it extended into the Qiang era. So first of all, I really commend Priyanka for this presentation. I mean, she has brought out the political logic quite interestingly. I mean, right today, if you look at post Jiang's passing, there seems to be a great amount of love and respect for Jiang in China through various things. I mean, people posting from the view that it was an age of to stay young, innocent, naive, to actually posting all those memes, all those earlier videos of Jiang in different occasions. But that also brings to some serious questions on the fact that if you're seeing it from a political ideological perspective, that was also a period where China turned from its ideological and class narratives to more pragmatic or more market. And I mean, if one could extend to say that the capitalist turn of China has actually started in the era of Jiang Zemin. So, but I think people are juxtaposing Jiang with Xi, and it seems to be, it comes out as Jiang's era was much more better for people in terms of personal freedoms and others, or even, I mean, just to look at China's zero COVID policy, maybe that was a better era compared than to how the state is almost controlling the lives of citizens, even to a personal level. So if one could put down to that. But I would largely agree with what Priyanka has just said. In fact, that entire notion of how Jiang successfully steered the party and also the state in actually accepting this pragmatism, trying to build this consensus for the party to actually take the market and state route, even though he continued to face this pressure from the conservatives or the hardliners. Chen Yun's entire notion of bird in the cage, I mean, the party, the bird should be given, but the cage, the overall protective layer of the state, should actually be in such a way that it should not allow the bird to fly away. So that's the classic example, which I also believe now she is also trying to bring back whatever earlier what Qiang had tried to move away from that. I would just look at a couple of points. I think Priyanka did bring in the fact quite later, I mean, with regard to how the party has tried to combine, if one could say, all kinds of contradictions together with all these rationalities. I mean, so you have one hand, the party and the socialist ideology on one hand, and then also you have to move to the market and attract foreign capital or also adopt the market more aggressively. So how to tie both of them, then you find these new justifications, whether it is in terms of socialist market economy or even go back to the Tang era of trying to find the primary stage of socialism, that entire thesis. So the party at every level has been in a way trying to find new logics and rationalities to justify in a way and to combine all these contradictions together to find the justification for more and more reforms. I mean, it finally ends up in the three represents where you have actually correctly assessed that, of course, this is a capitalist turn. I mean, the entrepreneurial class is now being brought into the party, but you have to find a justification to actually bring them in. And that's why Jiang was able to put that theory in exposing that kind of theory. I would also say that whatever the developments that were happening in China, say from the late 80s post Tiananmen, which one could say concluded with China's accession to the WTO in 2001, that entire decade was also the time when globally things were changing. I mean, the global neoliberal turn, which comes at the beginning from the late 80s, it sort of moves in, but it's early in the 90s that really comes in, and that global neoliberal turn affects everywhere. I mean, the Indian liberalization case actually starts from early 90s, but again, in China, with all these reforms and especially in SOEs, you find that this somehow ties to the global turn that is already happening, and it kind of fits into the global neoliberal turn quite effectively. Even though Chinese might say that this is socialism with Chinese characteristics, but what you actually find is there is a lot of similarities which actually find within neoliberal globalization, which is actually taking place. The forces have already been unleashed, and a lot of what is happening in China also fits into aligns with that arrangement. So that is something we need to actually take into consideration while we are also talking about what is happening in China. I mean, the global picture or whatever is happening in the rest of the world is also kind of it. And that somehow also takes away some amount of exceptionalism with the party state tries to build for itself in that form. The second thing is which I wanted, I mean, you definitely came into it a little late, I think, Priyanka, because even though Chiang was doing all this, the other figure who has to be remembered and who cannot be, who also has to have an equal place in this is Churamji. And especially his entire motion, because the entire SOE reforms was actually supervised and held on from the front by Churamji. I mean, this entire policy document on mergers, layoffs, especially which had a lot of implications for labor employed in these enterprises. Sorry, I'm plugging in my area too there, but it is quite important. I mean, I was then wondering why you had not brought Churamji, but glad that you give him mention at the middle part. In fact, it has also implications for labor, especially with all the laid off proletariat from the SOEs at that point of time, and then the party, because this is a very contentious group. And how the party state is also trying to balance their interests in through various programs, some kind of vocational help. I mean, it has had a series of measures trying to re-employ them or provide them alternative ventures. But this entire big chunk of the proletariat or the big chunk of the workforce, that has also been a kind of headache for the party. I mean, it is and the party state. It is an important, significant group. So that is as far as this is concerned. So, I mean, I would say that entire decade from the late 80s or the beginning of 90s till 2000s, when China finally accedes to the WTO, that entire logic of how Chiang had been able to successfully put China on the path in spite of facing ideological contradictions or resistance from hardliners or the more Puritans within the party, that provides a very interesting picture. And I would really be glad to actually look to your manuscript, be converted into the book, which would, I hope, will fit all this into that narrative. Maybe I'll leave with one question because of this fact. I mean, as a discussion which clearly also emerges, is that every time the party also seems to greatly give emphasis on SOE reforms, and it constantly keeps in its documents, in policy speeches, it constantly says about the need for SOE reforms. But I was just wondering, what are those forces which are actually resisting these SOE reforms in China? I mean, we understand the same thing with hukou reforms when it comes to social policies. The resistance seems to be coming from the bigger cities, the local administrations, the pushback from urban citizens. But what stops, if that is the case, who are these resistance coming from? Who are these SOEs which are actually resisting reforms? What is their bargaining power in that case? How much bargaining strength do they have? What types of SOEs are these? How did they become this kind of a pressure group within the party, within the party circles? That would be something I would think that it would be good for you to throw some light on. Because SOEs are clearly the national champions which Chinese have brought forth, and it is, in fact, even in BRI, it is the SOEs which are driving this interest. So if that is case, what's the case, then what Why is the party not able to actually have its complete say, given that now we have Xi Jinping as the be-all and end-all? So why is he not able to have this control over the SOEs and in fact having these reforms? And even if you could also spell out what exactly are these reforms itself, because that also seems to be a complete black box as far as I'm concerned. What are these exact SOE reforms that are that has also been projected? So that would be a few points which I would seek some answers. But otherwise, I will once again congratulate you. It was a wonderful presentation, and at least it gives you a peep into how what are the political ideological turn that is actually happening, or the narrative that is being built by the party. So that I would really be happy for you to put some light on it. But let me leave that it was really a wonderful presentation, and I actually look forward to reading your work. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, I think that was a very good response to the issues, the many issues that you raised, Priyanka. And I think the two questions that he brings in the end, I mean, at one level are so basic and yet so fundamental to this whole problem of the state party and the SOEs. You know, this kind of conglomerates that have emerged, which are obviously controlled, owned by the state, the party state, which is in turn, you know, dealing with this whole problem of, you know, what was mentioned earlier, that, you know, the party itself has become one huge, large conglomerate with interests which are being basically pursued by the state-owned enterprise. So those are issues, and therefore part of the answer to Anand's question is what is preventing is the kind of vested interests that have emerged over the last two decades. But Xi Jinping is not going to find it easy to remove these vested interests, which have tied up within the state-owned enterprises, within the bureaucracy, both state and party. So yeah, would you like to take a quick 3-4 minutes to just address what you think are Anand's, there is one comment which from Ishita, who says she has the same question. So maybe you could take just 5 minutes, respond to what you think you would like to from Anand, and then maybe let's open up the floor.
Thank you, ma'am. Thank you, Anand. They were very, very useful interventions. Now, to your first point that you mentioned about labor, the workforce that was laid off as part of the SOE restructuring during Chiang Zemin Juronji's period. Now, what we see mostly in the consensus, mostly in the document that come out as a consensus between the various leaders and the elite, the Chinese polity, Chinese Communist Party, but there, of course, goes behind a lot of struggle, a lot of tussle within the party elites before the formulation of any economic policy announcement. Similarly, before the large-scale restructuring in terms of ownership was carried out in China, the issue of labor became an important point of contention between Jiang Zemin and Juronji. Now, if you look at Jiang's career right from 1989, the point of continuity or the line of continuity remains is his obsession with political stability. He's very careful not to destabilize the legitimacy of the Chinese Communist Party, or let's say the rent-seeking tendencies embedded within the party, and also the social stability by not sort of unsettling the various classes or the various groups who would, let's say, get affected with these kind of layoffs, especially the workers at these state-owned enterprises. And they are not the private entrepreneurs. They are not the other individuals who have vested interests in capitalism or other forms of ownership. Now, with that kind of debate, Chiang therefore warned Juronji not to go ahead with the reform in a fast-paced manner. And it started, therefore, as a pilot project in some provinces before it was carried out on a large scale, on a large number of provinces in China, and therefore to China as a whole. And something that he had clearly asked the provincial leaders to do as part of this SOE restructuring was to go slow with the entire process and not to be fast and be careful while undertaking these kind of restructuring. Of course, it was a period of reform without losers. It created a lot of social discontent in China. And Jiang Zemin's leadership, you rightly pointed out, tried to compensate the workers, especially through various vocational training programs, where the state providing incentives to these workers, compensational incentives to these workers, to take up some jobs outside the state-owned enterprises, let's say in TVs, township and village enterprises, small private firms, and other kind of businesses, small and medium-sized enterprises. And the point on WTO exceptionalism, yes, you are right that the entire global political economy, in fact, there were conditions enough within the global political economy, that sort of facilitated China's accession to the WTO, or let's say integration with the international economy, global economy. Most of these conditions were, we have to understand, were motivated by the changes that were happening in China. So it was a constant interaction of the domestic and the external. So it was not that China only changed itself to be part of the WTO, but if you look at the accession debates and the way accession was carried out, and especially years after China's accession, the WTO itself as a regime also underwent some major changes, even if they're very incremental with China's being part of the WTO, increasing the voices of the global South and the developing countries. And by exceptionalism, I would say that the number of years that China had spent in negotiating its accession-related process with the United States, and it was not only with the United States China had to negotiate. China was, of course, United States, the major key player, but also the other countries, be the countries of the European Union, other countries like Japan, and it was also similar time when Taiwan had applied for its membership in the WTO. So very, very interesting developments happening, and the accession-related negotiations, the grueling nature of the accession-related negotiations, in fact, point to the very interesting nature of, or let's say the complicated nature of GATT or WTO ownership that China could achieve after so many years. And again, to some sort of exceptionalism, despite the conditions being there in the global economy. And then the question that you had about the nature of the Chinese state, and especially the vested interests. What are these interest groups who are sort of preventing these reforms, and who have prevented these reforms to grow, or let's say to corporatize the state-owned enterprises? Now, these state-owned enterprises, they are important entities. And ma'am rightly pointed out, they are important entities within which state has carried out a lot of important political economic objectives. But in the process of these reforms, let's say of these mega mergers that were undertaken from Jiang and now under Xi Jinping, these state-owned enterprises have grown into these big conglomerates. Unlike the global mega mergers or acquisitions that happen, China or the Chinese leadership is not interested in plurality. What it is interested in is reducing the number of heads, most importantly, creating hierarchies as bureaucracies within the company. Now, despite the importance or the significance of these party committees within this Communist Party committees within these enterprises, and despite being one head in these mega mergers, these conglomerates have grown bigger in size in terms of exercising autonomy as far as the internal decisions are concerned. Of course, the appointments, the decision to appoint the directors, the decision to appoint people in key managerial positions lie with the state-owned, lie with the party committees, Communist Party committees, but the other decisions on a day-to-day basis are mostly taken by these enterprises themselves. And now with the going global strategy, with the increasing competitiveness of these state-owned enterprises, these firms within the particular industry, they are engaged in aggressive price war, price wars. And again, that was another reason why Xi and also Chiang carried out these mega mergers to sort of counter these price wars, to break these kind of wars between these firms, intra-firm kind of price wars, and to, of course, reduce the competitive angle, competitiveness between these companies within the same industry. But that's a problem that Xi Jinping is still grappling with, about these state-owned enterprises acting as independent and, most importantly, influential entities, especially when these entities are going abroad in terms of acquiring overseas markets and other kind of deals. And about the bargaining power, it is like these mixed ownership reform or the shareholding reform, if I may point out, it's a reform mostly to discipline these state-owned enterprises. And the entire anti-corruption program that Xi had carried out was again aimed at disciplining the state-owned, the leaders within these state-owned enterprises. Especially because these state-owned, these members within these state-owned enterprises, they not only act motivated by individual profits, but also are engaged in some sort of global competition. And therefore, they try and bypass the bureaucracy wherever possible. So this mixed ownership is mostly seen as one of the means to restructuring, and restructuring is not an end in itself. And these kind of reforms are, of course, not solutions to cure all problems.
All right. So now I think, thanks for that. I think we shall open it up for the general Q&A for the audience, which has landed up here. So do we have, chat box doesn't have any, but Rapaiji has raised his hand. So please, Rapaiji, go ahead. You'll have to unmute yourself. Rapaiji?
Yeah, I think I am unmuted.
Yeah.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, yes, perfectly.
Yeah, I think I will just... I was listening to Priyanka, and it is interesting that you covered a lot of ground. I wanted to bring up only two points. One is you partly covered in answering Anand's question. In the Chiang Samin era, I also look at... you see, one of his... managerial skill or managing the party and other components. I remember the way they separated the businesses from the PLA. That was a major issue because PLA was a very powerful lobby and still it's a powerful lobby. And he managed it. The order came, I think, somewhere in 99. And by next 5 or 10 years, they successfully completed. A lot of businesses were separated from the PLA. So that how that fitted into the overall SOE reforms and others. Then the West was thinking that once China started liberating, China will automatically become a capitalist state or a democratic state. But how that theoretical or hope of the West of a democracy separated, and how he initially managed, of course, with Xi, I won't get into that. That is a separate issue. But I think when we assess Jiang Zemin, what is your findings? Thank you.
There are no further questions. I guess we'll just keep a Q&A going one-on-one as and when they arise. Priyanka?
Thank you, sir. Yes. So, Chiang's, if you look at Chiang's prowess as a military leader, he had very much taken advantage of that. And especially with his control of the PLA, the first thing he did was to promote science and technology, to promote modernization, and to bring in science and technology. And what he did was he invited technologies from abroad. That was also one of the reasons why the foreign direct investment saw sort of an increase during the Chiang Zemin Chorongji's era, the technology transfer that happened through these increased FDI, which sort of allowed both the state-owned enterprises as well as the private enterprises during that time to make use. So therefore, the sign, and but again, in the critical technology sectors, be it nuclear, be it other kind of technologies, military technologies, what Chiang did was that he spearheaded, that he had entrusted these state-owned enterprises to carry out the science and technology program. And therefore, what we see in case of Xi Jinping now with the 20th Party Congress sort of expanding the mandate for Xi to build up technological reliance, mostly in civilian terms, this is not new. Chiang had done this late in 1990s, and with the large enterprise strategy, he had asked these enterprises, he had entrusted these enterprises to carry out the modernization program in the PLA. I think that's how he had manipulated both the state-owned enterprises and the private sector, both at the helm of these technology transfer through these FDI, and carried out the process of modernization. And about the expectations vis-a-vis China going capitalist after WTO accession, yes. The very reason why Clinton administration had agreed to the proposal from the business lobby of including China, of signing this major trade agreement with China, was the large domestic market that they were eyeing at that point in time. Apart from the Chinese domestic market, the other reason was that the WTO accession would serve as an important vehicle for China, serve as an important vehicle for the global economy to be able to bring China into their fold, into the neoliberal fold. But easier said than done. This was something which was the West's expectations, but we have to understand that China is not a monolithic state, and something which I would also like to respond to the previous question that Anand had asked. And there are several interest groups that operate within the party state. It is not only about the provinces, local governments, the provincial governments, and the local governments, but it is also about the horizontal interest groups or the various factions that operate within the Communist Party. And therefore, these interest groups acted as a major constraint, in fact, acted as a credible constraint, which sort of impeded China's further going down the capitalist road, which one sort of expected, West sort of expected, with China's joining of the WTO. The other reason is, especially with Hu Jintao and Xiaobao's coming into the power in 2002, one see the inability, and that's where I again go back to the point of the leadership networks, the party's embeddedness within the state, the inability of Hu Jintao and Xiaobao's leadership to be able to dissociate or disembed themselves from the interests of the state, as in from the various rent-seeking interests of the state. And therefore, it became very difficult for the next generation leaders to sort of continue with the pace of the WTO reform. And the important point and an important phrase in this direction I would like to say is, that China joined WTO in 2001, and it was hoped, in fact, many hoped in the West, that it would reduce the power of the state-owned enterprises. And 10 years later, and now again with 20 years later, what we see is that they remain stronger than ever. So yeah, thank you.
All right. Any more questions, comments? Looks like everybody's processing all that. All right, we have one in the chat box. Harima is asking whether you can shed some light on if and how China employs a dispute settlement system of WTO while making trade transactions with other countries. You're muted.
Yeah. Thank you for this question. Now, I have a very simple answer to this question, that China does not employ dispute settlement system of the WTO while making trade transactions. It's the other way around. If you look at the number of cases against China in the WTO, you would see that China faces the maximum number of cases, maximum number of dispute settlement cases, be it anti-dumping, be it any other kind of violations, trade violations, IPR-related violations in the WTO, of both from the developed countries as well as from the developing countries, including India. And China, in fact, has a complaint vis-a-vis the way the dispute settlement body works. And this has been a long pending grievance against the WTO DSP, which is that the way anti-dumping duties are used, the method used to calculate the anti-dumping duties in case of China is a very exceptional one. WTO uses two kind of methods to calculate anti-dumping duties, one for the developed countries and another for the developing countries. But within the developing countries, China, the method which WTO employs, the DSP employs to collect, to calculate the anti-dumping duties is very different. And that somehow puts China in a weaker position and in a vulnerable position, as a result of which the number of anti-dumping cases are very high against China. And it also becomes easier for any country to sort of drag China to the WTO DSP on the basis of these dumping related disputes.
Well, anybody else? Oh dear. You know, when there is such a limited number of questions from a fairly good audience, they're either processing all that they have heard because it's something new, something that they had never read or thought about or read about tangentially. So this is all, you know, in many ways, very informative, very insightful. So a great deal of pondering is going on.
Ma'am, can I come in or just, this is Anand here.
Yeah, sure.
Sorry, Priyanka, maybe I left it out during my remarks earlier. So I actually was interested into looking at, just the SOE policy as such, rather than looking at reforms and how this has happened. Has there been any qualitative difference in terms of which SOEs are prioritized under, say, Jiang Zemin? And then if you map that that route from Chiang to Rongzi era to Hu Wan era and now to Xi Jinping, Li Keqiang era, has there been any difference in terms of which SOEs are kind of prioritized, which are actually need to have actual reforms? In that, are some SOEs like holy cows, which need to be kept away? You don't speak much on them, don't experiment or have any kind of reform initiatives. Has that continued? Do you think there is a continuum right from Chiang till Xi, or have there been some kind of qualitative changes? For instance, this question is also necessitated by the fact that in BRI, you have SOEs very largely involved. And I mean, this also extends to China's going out strategy as well. But with post Xi coming in and the BRI actually being into force, have certain SOEs got priority in a way? I mean, in the sense, in the extractive sector or in infrastructure development sector, has that happened? So basically, my question is on qualitative differences in terms of SOE policies and what SOEs or which SOEs are actually core to what the party's interests, right from Jiang Zemin to Xi Jinping.
All right, I'm going to tag one more here, Priyanka, and then you can take both. This triggered off by Anand's point on prioritization or the kind of focus that Chiang Zemin brings to the state domain, state-owned enterprises domain. Now, it's quite, of course, with Jack Ma and the whole fiasco that comes about under Xi Jinping, it's forgotten that it was under Chiang Zemin, actually, that e-commerce starts to emerge as a major kind of area. And somewhere towards the end of the 90s or early 2000s, I'm not too sure, I'm speaking from memory, he actually goes around, he speaks in APEC, he speaks in different fora in China, within China as well, where he's saying that e-commerce is the way of the future. And so China is among practically the earliest of the countries to get on to this this wagon of e-commerce and put a whole lot of investment into it. And then, of course, brings it within the SOE domain. So how does that work out? I mean, could you shed some more light on those priorities of Chiang Zemin?
Thank you. Thank you, ma'am. Thank you, Anand. Yeah, those are very important questions, especially about whether there we see a continuity. Yes, definitely. There is a continuity as far as the emphasis on particular kind of SOEs is concerned. And that perhaps also tells the story clear about whether we see a break with the past, a complete reversal, of course, under Xi Jinping. And the whole process began with the creation of these national champions. Of course, what constituted these strategic sectors varied from time to time with the leadership's shifting emphasis, but more or less these national champions sectors that were identified as national champions remained same. So in case of Chiang Zemin, these national champions were mostly in the field of infrastructure, for railways, roads, airfields, also the entire airline reform that was brought about in late 1990s. Then also in the field of nuclear strategic technologies. And here to ma'am's question about the entire e-commerce. So in early 1990s, when Chiang Zemin was undertaking these inspection tours in the special economic zones, he asked one of the provincial leaders about the stock listing. He was interested. He showed considerable admiration for these stock listing of the companies. And that was, again, that what had prompted him to think on these lines, let it be eco-beat or e-commerce or other kind of aspects. And the entire WTO accession, although we do not have mention of e-commerce as such, but we see certain kind of tariff reductions happening, be it in insurance, be it in telecommunication. In fact, 4 rounds of tariff reductions was carried out in agriculture, in other kind of services. And where, again, e-commerce mentions gets a very, very tiny attention because e-commerce is still debated within the WTO. And recently, again, we see some sort of a continuity in Xi Jinping era that China, in fact, becomes the first developing country to rally the developing countries, other developing countries, as well as to form sort of a plurilateral agreement kind of negotiation with the other developed countries on e-commerce, on the entire business of e-commerce. And that's where India sort of divorces itself from the from China and the other developing countries vis-a-vis e-commerce negotiations. And then the question of creating these national champions, therefore, we see that kind of continuity in Xi Jinping's period, and mostly it is in the strategic sectors. The political priorities, the strategic priorities, the geopolitical ambitions have grown very stronger under Xi Jinping. And where we see the state-owned enterprises are now being entrusted with enlarged responsibilities to take up these jobs. So there is a continuity as far as these process of creating national champions and then now asking these national champions to go global, to acquire overseas markets, as well as to spearhead technological building and some sort of self-reliance in other kind of technologies in China.
All right, Nishant has his hand raised.
Yes, Bob. So my question is regarding the role of SOE in social services. So back in 1990s, we see that because of the SOE reform, there was a reduced sense of responsibility of the SOEs in covering education, healthcare, and other pension benefits for the workers that were employed there. And this resulted in a staggering increase of local revenue, local expenditure of the governments, because they had to chip in and cover those things. Recently, what we are seeing is that private companies, you know, are chipping in like Tencent, Pinduoduo. They invested, they spent a lot of money in social services. Some said that it is possibly because of the tech crackdown, so they are trying to appease the central government. But could it also be that somewhere down the line, the central government is now nudging these private sector companies to perform some you know, social welfare functions? And what do you think does it say about the role of SOEs in covering those responsibilities in the present time? Because I'm not sure how much SOEs are contributing to fulfilling these you know, public welfare functions. So if you could please comment on that.
Thank you, Nishant, for that question. So SOEs, of course, always had these dual functions right from their inceptions. The first is, of course, the social stability, the redistributive justice function that SOEs were entrusted with. They were seen as agents of political stability in China, more than as economic stability, especially during Mao era. And of course, in Chiang Zemin, Chu Ranji's era, SOEs, the very reform of the SOEs pointed to the pragmatic, planned socialist market economy within which China carried out the reform, where again, SOEs, large enterprise strategy, was at the helm of carrying out, spearheading different kinds of reforms and attracting technologies from abroad, as well as going global and acquiring new kind of markets. Now, as far as these private players are concerned, one would then argue that under Xi Jinping era, what we see is an increasing kind of crackdown happening on the private sector. So therefore, the question that comes to our mind is that, is private sector even capable in China? Now, there's no question that the Chinese private sector is capable. If you look at the employment, the employment generation from the private sector, in fact, it's the private sector in China, which contributes to the maximum urban employment, right? And it is also creative. It can do anything. Now, the question is whether the government is going to create conditions of where that can happen, or whether it's going to continue to exert more and more control, like which will, of course, increase tension, not just with the United States, but also with the capitalist world. Now, having said that, the recent crackdown in crackdown on certain tech companies, these private companies like Alibaba, Baidu, doesn't capture the entire story of the private sector vis-a-vis the state-owned enterprises. This has to do with the changing political priorities with Xi Jinping government, the very long-term economic model that she, or the new kind of economic model that she is promoting. And of course, the contents of it are still poorly known and less understood. It's sort of still evolving with the slogans like common prosperity, national rejuvenation, and all of that. One needs to understand that what Xi Jinping is trying to focus on or bring the market to do is to serve as a tool of the state to fulfill the political priorities, less the economic goals, and not be bothered about economic growth, but more with the political stability, economic stability, and not with the growth per se. And therefore, when Baidu and Alibaba faced crackdown, Huawei was very much supported for spearheading the entire semiconductor development. Right, where what happened to Baidu and Alibaba then? Now, Baidu and Alibaba, beyond a point after 2000s, what we see that they became engrossed sort of with their own design development and had outreached a lot of its activities to Japan, to Taiwan, to South Korea. Whereas Huawei was carrying out more sort of a state goal of developing semiconductors for China's for China's technology capability building. Now, the entire crackdown was to sort of tell them to do the party line, and most importantly, to contribute to the national political goals, to the political priorities, and not be sort of motivated or obsessed with their self innovation goals. And recently, what we see is that both Baidu and Alibaba, they are now working with the government, with different think tanks, and with universities, Tsinghua University, where they are developing these chips, semiconductor chips, which are seen as first of its kind, where China has escaped this leapfrogging strategy, and especially in the light of increasing sanctions from the United States. So what this crackdown also tells us is that the policy content or the policies, the goal of these policies have sort of changed. The priorities have changed, but the means sort of remains the same, to sort of use the market in a much more regulated, in a much more controlled fashion.
Right. So do we have any more questions or comments? Something in the chat? No, that's Nishant saying thank you, Priyanka.
I think Alkaram has dropped out. Parthu, is ma'am in the meeting room?
Not that I can see. No, she's not.
All right. So Priyankati, I don't see any questions in the chat box. Nor any raised hands. So I think we can wrap up the session. I was waiting for Alkabam to give some concluding remarks.
I think let's wait for her to come back.
Yeah, we can. We can just wait for a minute or so.
Meanwhile, if there are other people who want to ask questions, please go ahead.
I think ma'am is back. Do we have any more questions? So ma'am, I think we could wrap up. We are waiting for you to give the concluding remarks.
No, I'm so sorry. It just like the light went poof like that. There I was staring at. I mean, the net just collapsed with the... I am back here now. And I think I heard Rija say that if there are no more questions, we can express our collective gratitude to... Yeah? Somebody saying something? What? Sounded like another language. All right, that's background music. Priyanka, thank you very much. Very refreshing, very interesting, and informative talk. And as Anand said, we really look forward to your completing the manuscript soon and have a chance to read your work. This is a research which is very necessary for us in India. You know, this the entire arena of the state-owned enterprises represents a huge challenge to us, where we are also, you know, in the midst of this mixed economy, where the role of the state and the role of the ruling parties, and then we talk in terms of the nexus between the parties and the corporate interest and so on. So these are issues which are obviously of great interest to us. And so your research will be extremely eagerly awaited and very necessary for scholars in our universities and campuses, because from the perspective of a young Indian research scholar, you would probably bring in different elements to your understanding of this state and industry nexus. So thank you very much. And thank you all, everybody who joined, asked questions, were part of the audience, and looking forward to having you again with us next week. We propose to discuss another aspect of Chiang Zemin's era or his rule, where we will be looking more at the foreign policies and try and focus on India-China relations during this Chiang Zemin era. So look forward to welcoming you all next week. Thanks again, Priyanka.
Thank you, ma'am. Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you for having me.